Over! Pendulous grinned. And I trust you're glad to see it gone. Dillinger waved one hand. If mornings want us to enjoy them, then they shouldn't be so bright. But yes, I'm up. Ambulatore. And of the belief, the best way to stir my sluggish blood is a game of run. Run? A game. A sport. Invented by my dear departed brother, Yonovan. Would you do me the honor of a match? Naturally, Pendulous said. Dillinger smiled. Know the rules? How would I? But that's my favorite sort of game. I find that having no clue what I'm doing relieves the awful pressure of having to do well. That's the spirit. Dillinger turned from the window. Without another word, the servants vanished into the house, scurrying to make preparations. Shall I change into sporting gear? Pendulous said. The Duke shook his head. The help will bring the hats. He led the way to the base of a long, high hill. Down its center, the grass had been clipped in a 40-foot-wide swath. Fine mesh fences bordered it on both sides. A canal ringed the finish of the trimmed trail. Dillinger sat at a table shaded by a pagoda. A servant materialized with a tray of strong drinks. Dillinger winked at Pendulous. The staff dragged out a straw-stuffed cart that smelled like a barn. Other servants retrieved curious vehicles, broad planks with four high wheels and a rib-high T-shaped steering column. Lastly, a rack of long-handled mallets was rolled beneath the pagoda. Dillinger nodded cursorily, and the servants began to drag the diverse equipment up to the top of the hill. Pendulous leaned back and sipped his drink. Why do I have the suspicion Run was fathered by a heavy dose of wine? Because you are wise in the ways of sport. Dillinger laughed. Now, where are our hats? He had no more spoken the word than a servant arrived bearing two hats, their brims as broad as platters. Pheasant feathers jutted from the crowns, iridescent green. Dillinger screwed one onto his head, smoothed the felt brim, and frowned, face creased with gravitas. They may strike you as silly, but the first rule of Run is if you lose your hat, you lose your bet. Wagers, Pendulous said. Now I know we're playing my kind of game. He smiled, sly. What are the stakes? Since it's your first round, I'll take it easy on you. I thought to send you home with a couple bottles of my finest, bottled right here on these grounds by my brewmeister. But should you lose, then you get first pick of the cabinet in my carriage. He cocked a brow. Challenge accepted. Dillinger clapped his thighs, stood, and headed up the hill. Have you deduced the premise? Attempt to ride to the bottom without breaking my neck? Oh, that would be far too easy. Dillinger pointed to the crown of the hill, where four servants had wheeled the planked vehicles. There's our starting line. You'll be given a few moments to get your legs under you. He pointed to the gamey-smelling hutch positioned a third of the way down the slope. Then the rabbits are released. We shall be equipped with one of the fine mallets you saw earlier. Your task? To prevent the rabbit from reaching the ditch. Which they were crossing via a board bridge at that moment. Pendulous shaped his face into amusement. Delightful. I had the feeling you'd approve, and that your physical skills would be up to the challenge. I don't invite just anyone to play a round of Run. I can imagine, Pendulous said. Considering the guts some of our lords lug around, you'd need more than a plank to bear them down the hill. You'd need a mule team. Dillinger chortled. Pendulous kept the rest of his thoughts to himself. The Duke was presenting this as a bit of frivolous entertainment, one more idle to get them through the dreary days of aristocratic life. Yet Pendulous suspected it was a not-so-subtle test of his mettle. His success or failure at bashing some bunny's terrified brains out would hold deep sway over Dillinger's choice to enter a business arrangement with him. Pendulous tugged the brim of his floppy hat, pulling it rakishly off-center. If the Duke wanted a show, then a show was what he would get. The autumn afternoon was barely warm. A hesitant breeze wove through the tall grass outside the mesh fence. They walked past the hutch. The servants there nodded in salute. At the top of the hill, the two conveyances were chocked in place with wooden blocks. Just behind the vehicles stood the rack of mallets, each a different color, the heads a variety of shapes and weights. All were flecked with rusty stains. Dillinger gestured. "As the guest, you have your choice of sword and steed." Pendulous approached the rack, hefted a black lacquered mallet, frowned, then replaced it and took a red one instead. "Red makes it go faster." The top of the steering column on one of the plank carts was carved into the head of a dragon. Pendulous shook his head. "Too common. It's the tiger for me." He touched the figurehead of the second, a snarling cat, and stepped atop the planks. The platform was springy, and better balanced than he'd anticipated. Dillinger took a bright white mallet with flared striking surfaces and mounted the dragon. "Are you ready, sir?" "Born to it," Pendulous smiled. The expression was his most sincere since arriving at the manor. Dangerous as this game appeared, it was good to be back in the saddle, so to speak. Anyway, even if he suffered a broken bone or two, Run was far less dangerous than the game he'd been playing for the past year. It had been 3 years since he'd dashed from Narashtovik. Initially, he'd installed himself in a border town on the river between Garsk and the newly independent Norrin territories. For weeks he plotted revenge against Dante for the death of Lyra. Then, fearing he might actually take it, he sailed away. Across the north coast of Garsk, the heaving white seas of Umber, south past the metropolis of Voss and the black bluffs of Pocket Cove. It felt good to be alone, anonymous. For the first time in a long time, he had no responsibilities at all. He'd hired on as a mercenary, but the vessel encountered no strife besides a couple of storms. He spent a long time on the deck watching the water. He tried to forget, and failed badly. But the waves numbed him, endless, gray, and empty. After the fragmented Middle Kingdoms, the ship hooked east past the rocky Carlin Islands, Lyra's homeland, and all the way to his homeland of Bressel, capital of Malin. There he made port for good. He intended to stick around a while, to kick back and catch up with old friends. But it had been better than 7 years since he'd last lived in Malin, and he hadn't had many friends to begin with. The few who remained knew nothing about him except that he'd once been a kid named Blaze. The awkward talk made him keenly aware how little Malin meant to him. He'd been born and raised in that place, but the city had since become something else. And so had he. Within days, he hopped a barge upstream to Wetton. There he fell in with Robert Hobble, who had retired from the city guard to pursue a life of leisure. Robert was overjoyed to see Blaze, and didn't press for news of Dante. They passed the next year as drunkards, tossed out of a new tavern every night. Sometimes they passed out in their chairs. Other nights they swapped stories and rambled about life until dawn showed up to expose them. It was so easy to do. He promised himself it was temporary, but each morning brought him a new hangover, and each hangover demanded another evening of drinking. Within 2 months he was getting his start in the afternoons instead. Soon enough he was waiting for the toll of the midday bells. The drink brought relief from the curse of memory. It punished him too, and when he allowed himself to dwell on this, he discovered he wanted that as well. Blaze could feel himself falling apart, but the hole in his chest welcomed it. 13 months after debarking in Wetton, Blaze woke in an inn with bloody hands. After a few minutes, he remembered he killed a man in a duel, but couldn't recall what the dispute had been about. Afraid of a hanging, and of what he'd become, he retreated into the woods. Wandered north, living off the land, dimly aware he was retracing old steps. After a couple of weeks, he stumbled upon the town of Shea. He strolled about, vaguely happy to see no sign of Samaran's rebellion that had burned whole sections of the town, and found himself in the yard of a monastery. It was Gabe's. Gabe, the Norrin monk who'd helped Kali retake his place at the head of the Council of Narashtavik. For that aid, Kali had rewarded him with the Chainbreaker's War. It had freed the Norrin, and taken the lives of thousands. When Blaze announced himself to the Acolyte, he wasn't certain what he intended to do. Kill Gabe on sight, maybe? Harangue him, at the very least, to wound him with guilt and leave him festering? Instead, when Gabe ducked through the doorway, 7 feet tall and as hairy as a bear, Blaze found himself too weary to do more than wave. He grunted his way through the conversation, but Gabe sussed him out easily enough. He led Blaze to his cell, sat down, and asked what was wrong. "What isn't?" Blaze said. Not very witty, but he hadn't felt light enough for wit since leaving wet and bloody-handed. Gabe's voice rumbled through the close space. "Did you come here for counsel?" "You church boys have it all figured out, don't you? That's why you live your lives in a room smaller than a water closet. Very easy to be wise when you never step out to face the world." Gabe clasped his hands, leaned forward, and frowned at the floor of his cell. "The soul is a piece of paper. It starts life blank and pure. In time it gets dark with age, especially if it is left to face the elements. With care and correct process, however, you may wash it clean again, and even if it's crushed, crumpled in a cruel fist, once that fist finally lets go, what does the paper do?" "Gets thrown away." "It unfolds, all by itself." "Time," Blaze muttered. "That's everyone's answer to everything." He left, 2 minutes later. The god's highest wisdom was no different than what peasants told each other after a house fire or the loss of a child. It wasn't true, though. Time didn't build a thing up. It eroded it. Eventually, it killed it. This advice wasn't even meant for the recipient. A man with an arrow through his leg doesn't want to hear that it won't hurt that much after he's had a year to heal. That information is worthless to him. It's insulting, cruel, and impossible to know. The wound might never heal, leaving him with a limp for the rest of his life. It could become infected, killing him in days. That was what pain meant. Something is very wrong, and you had better do something to fix it. If you're standing in a fire, you don't wait for time to put it out. He wintered in a cave in the woods near Shea. Sometimes he slept in the open, as if daring the wolves or the elements. Hunting and fire-building occupied most of his time, but when he had open hours he walked aimlessly through the snows, enjoying the silence and stillness, the sensation of being so close to the edge. The snows disappeared, and he was still there. He knew that he could live like that for decades, if he chose, like a one-man Norrin clan. Aside from the romanticism of being a forest hermit, however, it held no meaningful appeal. What was he supposed to do? Contemplate the leaves for 30 years? They were leaves. That was it. Yet, having lived like a Norrin, and recently spoken with one, he was inspired to learn how the rest of them had fared in the 2 years since the war. Had all that strife done them any real good? Or were they back in King Modigan's chains, despairing all the more after their brief taste of freedom? He struck north for the Dundons, and made his way through the pass. He exited from the mountains into the foothills, and discovered the Norrin's independence had endured. That was surprising and welcome news. Still, a part of him resented their happy travels. That part had hoped they'd be just as miserable as he was. His little quest had returned him within spitting distance of Narashtovic. That wouldn't do. He'd already had to take pains to avoid the Clan of the Golden Field and the other Norrin who might recognize him. Yet he had no desire to return to the forests outside Shae. It was time, then, to decide what to do with the rest of his life. Working for someone else was out of the question. That ruled out guard and mercenary jobs. He didn't want to become a highwayman, preying on the innocent. He could probably make it as a Nolladun gambler. Mixing it up in Norrin taverns could be a hell of a lot of fun. But in the end, Nolladun was just a game. He could take a different form of inspiration from the Norrin, and find a Nulla to hone into a living. But all he'd ever been good at was fighting, scheming, escaping. Lyra. There were others besides Dante to blame for her death. Cassander, of course. But he'd already paid, dropping into the rift with all his men. Mardigan and his supporters, then. Ambitious, destroying a king and his court single-handed. But Blaze had his whole life to dedicate to the task. And he didn't have to do it alone. From the Norrin Hills, he struck west to Galador, which, after a vicious 2-year campaign, had last fall struck an uneasy truce with the shrinking state of Garsk. The terms redefined Galador as a protectorate, semi-autonomous. No one on either side was happy with the arrangement. One spring night, with the wash of the waves, the lake city's only sound, Blaze rode to Lolligan's Island Manor and, once Lolligan recovered from his shock, which he got over as soon as he learned Blaze was there to discuss his two favorite things, money and destroying Mardigan, the two of them pieced a plan together. Backed by Lolligan's tea-salt fortune, along with funds smuggled from the Tradesmen's Association of the Greater Valley of Galador, Blaze would don the disguise of a wealthy merchant and travel to Setevan. There, he'd use his vast wealth to embed himself in the aristocracy and systematically ruin, disgrace, bankrupt, and or murder every vizier, duchess, lord, and king who'd been involved in the Chainbreaker's War and ensuing Lakeland Rebellion. Obviously, it wasn't without risks, not least of which was the fact Blaze Buckler was infamous across Greater Garsk. But he had reason to believe he could pass as a stranger. In the tradition of all heartbroken men, he'd let himself grow shaggy and bearded. Trimmed to befit his fake station, and dyed from blonde to rich brown, he looked like a new man. His nose, meanwhile, had been crooked in a fight in Wetton. His skin was tan from travel, and his face was aged beyond its years. But he would have done it even if he'd looked exactly the same. A year later, through methods so sly his spies in the city hadn't heard a single credible whisper linking it to him, Blaze's dealings and intrigue had knocked out several beams from the House of Mardigan. He'd caused the bankruptcy of a baron and two usurers who'd funded the war, the divorce of Baron Halibard from the bloodthirsty baroness, the murder-suicide of Lord Wedderburn and his wife, who had become pregnant while the Lord was on business in the Middle Kingdoms. Blaze had felt guilty about this last outcome. Then his right hand, Taya, who had once met him on a Wending rooftop dressed all in blue, told him that at the end of the Chainbreaker's War, rather than freeing their Norrin slaves, the Wedderburns had put them to death. All told, 3 years had passed since he'd fled from Narashtovic. He wouldn't call them good years. If you were to ask him if he were happy, he'd laugh. But he had found purpose. That was more than most men could say. He was currently playing a long and elaborate con on Dillinger, who was not only a duke, but Modigan's sister's second son. Lolligan believed that if Dillinger were to lose his fortune, a fortune loaned him by Modigan, Gask would teeter toward insolvency. The instability could turn a rebellious splinter of the court against the king. After the losses and failure of the war, Modigan's influence had faltered while his rivals made strides toward the throne. With the right pressure, and a bit of luck, he might be toppled. Wildblaze and Lolligan kept their hands sparkling clean. Thus this ludicrous ruse, culminating in a bone-breaking ride down a hill, all for the purpose of smearing a helpless rabbit across a lawn that must take days for the servants to trim. Blaze, pendulous to his oblivious marks, shook his hair from his brow, gripped his mallet, and nodded to the servants holding the ropes attached to the blocks in front of the board's wheels. The servants yanked the chocks clear. Blaze's cart lurched forward, quickly gaining momentum on the trimmed lawn. He bent his knees and gave an experimental turn of the cart's handles. It responded violently, yawing to the side. He dropped his weight and let it right itself.
"Not as easy as it looks, is it?"
Dillinger shouted into the mounting wind.
"Treacherous as Hukali Bay," Blaze replied.
The cart rattled and jolted and banged. The mallet felt long and awkward. Blaze took a practice swing and nearly fell into the grass. He scowled and tried again, spreading his feet and leaning away from the direction of his swing. "March steadier." Dillinger laughed. As they neared the hutch, Blaze made a series of slight adjustments to his handlebars. It was extremely sensitive. It didn't help that they were barreling down the hill at a speed that could only be described as heart-bursting. Moments before they reached the hutch, the servants swept open the doors, reached for the lanyards around their necks, and blew into wooden whistles. Two rabbits, one brown, one white, dashed onto the trimmed grass, got one look at the two men jouncing toward them, and fled downhill.
"Run!" Dillinger whooped. "Run, run, run!"
"So that's where the creative name came from," Blaze said. The rabbits opened up ground on the one-man wagons, bolting 20 feet ahead. They had hardly ridden down half the hill, however, and as the bunny's initial sprint flagged, the carts began to close. Dillinger crouched, angling towards the brown rabbit. His tires kicked over a stone, swerving his cart. Expertly, he tweaked its course back on track. Blaze lowered himself as well, increasing his momentum. Dillinger closed on his mark, cocked his white mallet, and swung. He clipped the rabbit's tail. Spooked, it burst forward, zagging toward the fence. Dillinger swore and veered toward it at a shallow angle. They were now 3/4 down the hill, coming fast to the flat ground before the ditch. Blaze matched pace with the white rabbit, hanging 8 feet behind it, timing its strides. His hat flapped, loosening. He yanked it down around his ears, and his cart wobbled wildly. The brown rabbit moved away from the fence in arcing hops. Dillinger pursued, widening his stance on the bouncing plank. He drifted near the rabbit and swung. Catching sight of his motion, the rabbit cut back toward the fence. Dillinger's stroke whooshed through empty air. He tried to correct his swing, leaned hard left, and toppled from the cart in a spray of sod and curses. Uphill, servants cried out. Blaze grinned and bent down, nearing the white rabbit. The slope was beginning to gentle. In another couple seconds, it would level into the final approach to the canal. He'd be bleeding speed all the way. He flung his mallet to the side. Whoops! The rabbit streaked on. Blaze leaned forward, passing it, then leapt backwards from his cart. The shocked bunny bounded straight through the air. Blaze snatched it up, tucked it to his chest, and came down on his shoulder, rolling head over heels, hanging onto his hat with one hand. It came to a stop on his backside and scruffed the rabbit. Head spinning, elbows and knees scraped and grass-stained, he stood and held the animal aloft.
"Your booze is mine, sir!" he called uphill.
Dillinger had managed to arise from the torn-up turf. He cocked his head expectantly. Blaze walked to the fence, held the rabbit at arm's length, and dropped it on the other side. It gazed up at him with its button eyes, dazed, then turned and bounded into the tall grass. Dillinger dismissed his hovering servants and limped downhill.
You let it go?
Glay shrugged.
That Jack was the finest runner I've ever seen.
Per the rules, you're to strike it. It's customary to celebrate a run victory with an immediate grilling session. My gods, we don't even have a winner.
I thought it would be more productive to let it loose to spawn more rabbits for future games.
Rabbits are cheap. Dillinger knocked grass from his hair and gazed at the canal. Blaze's tiger-proud wagon had careened straight into it and was currently floating on the green water.
Shall we get cleaned up? Have another drink?
Blaze smiled and bobbed his head.
Certainly.
He accompanied the Duke back to the manor. He'd made a mistake. Allowed the blaze to pierce through the pendulous. As if a bunny meant anything compared to his revenge. Despite this, he doubted it would matter. Money always won out in the end, and the bargain he was offering Dillinger was far too sweet to refuse. Inside, he stripped off his sweaty clothes and rinsed in a tub of hot water, refusing the servant's assistance, not out of modesty, but the fact he didn't want anyone getting a close look at the scars he'd earned during the war. It was paranoid, to be sure, and inconsistent, given how readily he'd taken advantage of the servant's labor so far, but he could no longer allow any room for mistakes. Bathed, dressed, perfumed, and trimmed by the manor's barber, he headed back to the sitting room for another drink and yet another period of extended downtime, while the Duke busied himself with the various duties, real and fake, that made Dukes look so damned important. By the time Dillinger arrived and invited him to the main table, a solid slab of pink-veined marble, it was in that lazy time between afternoon and evening, and all Blaze had accomplished on the day was riding down a hill without dying. There were more drinks, followed by trays of small foods. Quail eggs, roasted garlic and mushrooms, oysters shipped in from Yalan, and conversation about next month's annual horse race at the palace. Just when Blaze was beginning to think he'd have to spend another day in this overstaffed nightmare, Dillinger swirled his drink, swished it around his mouth, swallowed, and fixed Blaze with a look.
I've let you dangle long enough, don't you think?
Blaze smiled vaguely.
In front of a big investment, the boldest man can get skittish. I've sat on the hook for longer.
Dillinger chuckled.
Well, sooner or later, I may have some actual work to do. I have a few questions for you.
Of course.
First, how did you ever forge such a connection? The Norren would rather hack off their own legs than do business with someone connected to the capital.
Blaze had a cover for this, of course, but he took a moment to think. These were dicey waters. Because the goods in question were of Norren origin. Until their little rebellion 3 years ago, the Norren territories had been a vassal state of the Gascon Empire. Entire clans had been owned as slaves by men just like Duke Dillinger. The clans had emerged from the conflict victorious, but with great losses. Relations with their former masters in Setevan were not what you'd call chummy. Yet, perhaps out of some perverse sense of guilt, Setevan's blue bloods had taken a shining to the Norren people's art, which was as voluminous as it was well-crafted, and none was more coveted, and thus more expensive, than bossen. Technically, bossen referred to a wide spectrum of clothes, gloves, leggings, shirts, jackets, and so on. What united them were the manner of their construction. Through a fiendish process of tanning and stretching, each piece of bossen was made from a single piece of seamless leather. Deerskin, usually, though Norren being Norren, others specialized in cowhide and sheepskin. One enterprising tailor had even made headway with the hides of sharks. Human tailors had managed to duplicate some of the simpler forms, but anything more complex than an open-ended tube remained the domain of the Norren masters. Who didn't give a shit how much Setevan nobles offered to pay, now that Norren were recognized as people and thus capable of being paid? Blaise, however, had friends in every corner of the Norrin lands. He had access to as much bossen as he could afford. If he could catch Dillinger in the craze, filling his warehouses with the prized clothing, it would be a simple matter to flood the market with more before Dillinger had the chance to offload it, thus ruining him, as well as everyone else who'd speculated in the bubble market. Blaise was connected to the Norrin. The Duke wanted the goods that connection provided. But if Blaise, as Lord Pendulous, appeared to have achieved that connection through unscrupulous means, say, supporting the Norrin during their war effort against Dillinger's uncle, it would mean the end of his scheme on the spot. "For years I've done business with a Norrin chieftain," Blaise explained. "She's a rather unique woman who was initially promoted to her position due to her philosophical stance on the benefits of open commerce. She considers it a moral failure that her fellow Norrin might be hesitant to let the product of their sweat fall into corrupt human hands. Thus, acting as my middleman is a righteous act." Dillinger tipped back his head. "Don't the Norrin craftsmen know she's going to turn around and sell their wares to humans?"
"She is very convincing," Blaise laughed, "and you would be amazed how well the simple buffer of a Norrin middleman can assuage the stings of the conscience.
They don't know I'll be the one buying their bossen. As far as they know, it'll be sold to the clan of the Wheezing Goose."
"They call themselves the Wheezing Goose?"
"It's just an example."
"Then you're lucky to have found her."
The Duke drank from his mug.
"What about quantity? Anyone looking to make a venture of this would have to have enough to make it worth their while."
"Naturally, supply is limited," Blaise said. "Though not as much as you'd think. I've been accumulating it in preparation for the right buyer."
"When do you expect to have your supplies at hand?"
"The main wagon arrives next week." Blaise allowed himself half of the smile fighting for his face. "How much were you interested in acquiring?"
"Order enough, and I can offer a discount as steep as your Runhill."
"Acquiring?"
Dillinger's eyebrows shot up.
"Afraid I've stamped you with the wrong signet, chum. I was just curious to hear how you handled the Norrin."
"You can't be serious.
Why field my proposal if you had no interest in pursuing it?"
"I had every intention of pursuing it," the Duke said, a hint of warning in his eyes.
"Unfortunately, while you are in transit here, my circumstances changed. Disagreeably. I held hope some detail in your proposal would render it feasible for us to do business despite my fresh hardships, but that is not the case. Regrettably, I must decline."
Blaise was too stunned to speak. Like that, months of preparation, and his closest shot at toppling the throne, vanished like yesterday's rain.
Chapter 3. Dante shouted and grasped wildly for the nether. The kappa thundered through the grass. It lowered its horns. Dante sent a bolt of raw shadow straight at the center of its forehead. It impacted with an anti-flash of pure black. The kappa charged on without breaking stride. Dante dove to the side. A spiral horn snagged his thigh, shredding his pants. Pain lanced up his leg. He cried out and thumped to the grass. The beast trampled past and swung about through a wide turn. Dante drew on the nether. His first effort had been weak, but now that it had blood to feed it, it surged like a storm-swollen creek, wreathing his hands in darkness. As the kappa charged anew, he struck it again. And again, the shadows dissipated on impact. An audible hiss fried the frigid air. Cold pins prickled Dante's scalp and spine. With a rasp of steel on leather, he drew his sword. As it closed on him, he flung himself out of range. It flew by. The wind of its passage smelled of pine sap and bog rot. The creature might not be able to climb cliffs, but it looked perfectly capable of bashing down trees. It was armored like an 800-pound pill bug, built as solid as a rhino, but with the predatory grace of a tiger. And it was, apparently, impervious to nether. The only tree branches in reach were dried out and spindly, likely to snap if Dante put his weight on them. His only chance was to run into the trees and try to outmaneuver the Kappa as he returned to the cave and the cliff. He sprinted from the crest of the bald hill into the woods. It closed on him, feet pounding soil. He juked behind a pine. Branches snapped behind him, spitting splinters. Overhead, the strange lights played on, painting the woods in blazing pinks and greens, causing the shadows of the trees to waver on the frosty ground. Dante weaved around an ancient fir and jumped down a short ravine, skidding to a stop in front of a wall of brambles. He turned his shoulder and burst through a thin spot in the growth. Thorns scraped his hands and cheeks. With the lights in the sky to guide him, he knew he was headed in the direction of the cave, but he was still a few hundred yards from sanctuary. Even as he had that thought, the Kappa leapt down the ravine behind him, landing so hard Dante felt the impact in his soles. A storm of thrashing erupted behind him. Robbed of its momentum, the Kappa had become mired in brambles. Perhaps its armor was too thick to feel the thorns, and that's why it didn't cry out. Whatever the case, its silence was more unnerving than any howls or roars. With a few seconds of freedom, Dante quit dodging around trees and ran pell-mell toward the cave. As he sprinted away, he tried to grasp the nether inside the Kappa, meaning to shred its lungs and heart. But reaching for its insides was like reaching toward a pool of water and banging into solid ice. But there was more than one way to skin a Kappa. By the time it tore free from the brambles with a crash of twigs, he'd opened a lead of 100 feet. The monster galloped behind him, gaining swiftly. The dark wall of the cliff bobbed behind the pines. He wouldn't make it before the monster was upon him. "Dante!" Lou's voice carried through the trees. "Stay there!" he shouted. Still running, he called the nether from the darkness. 50 feet from the cliffs, with the Kappa crashing through branches and saplings, Dante whirled. The Kappa bounded forward. It would be on him in a moment. He thought about striking for its small, bright eyes, but dropped to one knee and punched the hard, frozen earth. A crevasse zigzagged from his hand. Brown pine needles cascaded into the gap. The ground cracked apart with a groan of rock. The beast snorted and tumbled into the pit. Dante stood, breathing hard. His heart felt like it would knock through his ribs. A cloud of dust drifted from the crack. Loose stones clacked to the bottom. His gashed leg throbbed. Keeping the nether close, he edged up to the pit and illuminated its bottom. Dust motes twinkled in the pale light. 20 feet down, the Kappa lay on its side beneath a patina of pebbles and sand. A shard of basalt spun down and plinked off the creature's plates. "Dante?" Lou called. "I'm fine," Dante replied over his shoulder. "The Kappa." A flood of stone rattled from the pit. The Kappa surged to its feet, shook off the dust, and leapt up the steep wall, claws scrabbling at the loose rock. Impossibly, it pulled itself closer to the top. "Oh, come on," Dante said. He might have struck at it again, or opened the rift even further, dropping it from a height that would crack even its iron-hard shell. But he was wounded, weakened, and panicked. He ran toward the cave, meaning to hole up, catch his breath, and assess the situation from a location where he wasn't in imminent peril of being impaled on spiral horns. Grass flew from his heels. Before he'd made it 20 feet, the Kappa heaved itself out of the pit and lumbered after him. Its footsteps thumped closer and closer. It snorted from its blunt triangular snout. Dante dashed through the pines, scratchy branches lashing his face. The Kappa tromped down hard, planting its weight, then made no sound at all. Dante threw himself flat. The beast flew over him, limbs extended, fat, fleshy tail sailing behind it. With a great crack, it smashed into the bole of a towering pine, its horns spraying bark. Dante spat dirt from his mouth. The Kappa's left horn had punched straight through the pine. Dante vaulted up and ran past it. Only then did it roar, a bone-shaking honk that nearly froze him mid-stride. A lantern flared from the cave. Dante launched himself at the cliff face and raced up the ladder he'd drawn to its side. Above, Lou craned from the entrance, eyes wild. Dante reached the opening and threw himself in.
"What's happening?" Lou screeched.
"I met a Kappa," Dante said, "and discovered their manners are extremely poor." Ast appeared beside them.
"You went outside, in the night."
"To see the lights I was sent here to investigate? Yes, how foolish of me." Ast gave him a long look.
"We don't live in high holes because we think the ground smells funny."
"Obviously, it makes more sense to me now." In the woods, the Kappa thrashed and yanked. With a great crack, its horn came free. The pine stuttered, popped, groaned, and fell, boughs hitting the dirt with the sound of incoming surf. The Kappa shook its head, backed up, and gazed straight up at Dante.
"Are they smart?" Dante said.
"I've never engaged one in conversation," Ast said. "As predators, however, they are impeccable."
"I noticed. They're impervious to Netha. No wonder the priests of ancient Narashtavik exterminated them. It would be like living barefoot in the land of loose nails."
"Where did it go?" Lou said.
Dante turned back to the woods.
Starlight glittered on frost. The trees stood alone. The only sound was the whisk of the breeze in the branches.
"You see what a hunter it is?" Ast said. "It's trying to trick us. Not wise to descend before dawn."
"No problems on that front," Dante muttered.
"It has successfully scared the shit out of me."
He watched the woods for a minute, then withdrew from the entry to tend to the deep red gash in his leg. The nether sewed it up with no trace of the wound but puffy pink flesh. Less could be done for the leg of his pants, but Lou had been an acolyte in the monastery for years and was well trained with the mending of the monk's robes and underclothes. By the time he finished, the pants were wearable, if susceptible to the winds. Somehow, Dante was able to get back to sleep. When he got up, it was an hour past dawn. The grounds around the cliff had been clawed up, but Ast had already climbed down to scout and assured Dante the Kappa was gone. As Dante ate breakfast and shook the fog from his head, he stared at the fallen pine. Its trunk was broken in jagged shards. He tried not to imagine what the Kappa's horns would have done to the trunk of his body. Once they'd eaten, they resumed their course into the mountains. They spoke little, crossing first the forest, then another field of sprawling talus. This descended to a high valley of waving grass, broken here and there by buttes. To the east, the direction of last night's lights, the ground sank in a series of terrifying cliffs. Miles away, the skyline was interrupted by a series of dominant peaks. The sun dropped. Ast began to search for a good place to set up a cave, looking for a cliff with an eastern exposure. He found a short butte, 40 feet high and carpeted with yellowing grass. For the third day in a row, Dante carved a hole in the wall and an inset ladder leading up to it. They ate their standard fare, which was dwindling. If they turned back toward Saul tomorrow, they wouldn't face any problems on the food front, but if they tarried beyond that, they'd have to forage or go hungry. The latter wasn't a pleasant scenario when they were marching up and down mountains all day long. Dante would probably be able to knock down a few birds and squirrels, but cleaning and cooking the game would slow them down. And he didn't like the idea of building a fire. All that smoke would be a dead giveaway of their presence. Never mind that they appeared to be completely alone in a pristine landscape. That just made him feel more exposed. They climbed up to the cave.
Dante had modified this one to have a higher entrance with a shallow deck-like landing that would permit all three of them to watch the night skies. Low clouds streaked past, reddened by the sunset. Within minutes, the day had fled, chased away by the stars and a quarter moon already halfway across the heavens.
"It was the Capper, wasn't it?"
Lou said, hushed.
"That's what's been killing the sheep."
"The bull-sized pile of teeth, horns, and impenetrable plate," Dante said. "What makes you think it's capable of killing a ball of wool?"
Ast surveyed the land below them, a brief plain interrupted by another sheer ravine. They had reached the last of what could be called the foothills. Any further east, and they'd be climbing into the staggering upslopes of the spine of the Wodans.
"It's usual for them to descend into shepherd territory," Ast said. "I've only seen two others in all my life here."
Dante glanced his way. "Yet, despite their rarity, Sol is built around protecting yourselves against them."
"They're rare because our ancestors learned to allow them no reason to come to our homes."
Dante chuckled. "Trust me, after facing one, or more accurately, backing one, as I fled from it at full speed, I would be living in cliffs, too."
Lou leaned forward. "Or getting the hell out of the mountains altogether."
Ast shook his head.
"People live in lands with hurricanes, wildfires, warfare that leaves the fields buried in 3 inches of ash. This is no different."
He was quiet a moment.
"Although the sight of a village ravaged by a Kappa is as grotesque as any war."
Dante opened his mouth to ask for details. Pink light seared across the east. At first it came in beams, straight from the sky, shading Lou's face rosy. Then the beams curled and dispersed into multicolored sheets of purple and green. For minutes the colors shifted and swirled, floating lower and lower until they seemed to graze the jagged peaks. Dante's interest waned. It was pretty enough, but so was everything in nature when you sat and looked at it. And with the exception of the initial beams, this looked like just another expression of the ghost lights. The Kappas were genuinely troubling, however. If the animals were venturing below their normal grounds, the Council of Narashtovik might be able to repay and curry favor with the eastern peoples by dispatching a force to root out the monsters. And Dante believed they'd have more to gain from such a venture than mere favor. If he could study a Kappa and determine what enabled it to resist the Nether, it could be a tremendous boon to the strength of Narashtovik's priests. It would lend them an advantage over every other Nethermancer in the land. Without warning, the lights coalesced from ethereal sheets into a tangle of curved lines. One thicker than the others stood straight in the sky, pointing to the heavens. Each of the thinner lines curved toward it, connecting to it. The light paled, until it was as silver as the stars.
"That's Bardon," Dante said flatly.
Ast leaned forward.
"The white tree?"
"It looks exactly like that."
"That looks like an oak."
"Really? How many oaks have you seen with branches like scimitars? Because remind me to stay away from that forest."
"They kinda look like swords,"
Lou squinted.
Dante frowned.
"Haven't they taken you to see it?"
"We're not supposed to visit, except on the holiest occasions."
"Well, that's ridiculous. Bardon sits at the center of our beliefs. Remind me to change that policy as soon as we return."
Lou watched him sidelong, attempting to gauge if he was serious, but Dante only had eyes for the tree in the sky. It shimmered, swaying not as if it were in a wind, but as if it were moving on its own power. The lights sharpened. Dante could make out the teeth budding from the bone branches, then collapsed into a single blinding flare. The ball of light wavered to the eastern peaks. It disappeared in a flash of white.
He blinked against the sudden darkness. The image burned into his vision.
Well, we have to go see that.
Did you mark the spot? Asked Zed.
How could I? It's miles away in the middle of the night.
My point exactly.
We've already come this far. I think we could spend another day to find the resting place of the awe-inspiring bundle of light.
The tall man shrugged.
You are the captain, but it could have come down anywhere in that range. It may take many days and better equipment than we've got to fully search it.
Dante shook his head, but didn't bother to argue further. He was the captain, and they would do as he said. This was something Ollivander continued to drill into him. Dante was used to operating on his own, accountable to a handful of superiors. Now he was the superior. People like Ast were accountable to him. It was his role to ask them for more than they believed they were capable of, and to recognize when they were correct. He didn't expect to search the whole range, but Ast could at least provide him with a look.
They watched for another hour. The night grew frozen, too cold for the chirrup of insects. An owl hooted for a while, then gave up.
After a little longer, so did Dante. As first light hit the ridges, he extricated himself from his blankets and returned to the mouth of the cave to try to mark the spot where the light had fallen. He believed he had it. A rocky bowl between two great peaks, elevated roughly halfway between the tree line and the snow line. It was just a few miles away, as the sparrow soars.
A lot further as the schlub walks, Blue said.
We'll be there by noon, Dante said. Spend the afternoon searching. If there's nothing to see, we head back towards Sol tomorrow morning.
But I didn't come all this way to turn around when I'm literally in sight of it.
It being...
I don't know, that's the whole point.
He glanced at Ast, but if their guide had opinions, he kept them to himself. They brought their gear down and headed across the grassy field. Very soon, a ravine etched the earth. It was 50 feet deep, yet no more than 30 across, and extended to left and right as far as Dante could see, blocking their way forward. It felt unnatural, as if the earth were a series of paving stones, and a flash flood had washed away the mortar that had once cemented these two together.
Ast lowered his pack and went for the rope.
Don't bother, Dante said. I'm through wasting time.
He sliced open his much-abused left forearm and fed the blood to the hungry nether. As it built, he reached his mind into the ravine's edge. The shadows waiting there were orderly, easy to grasp and eager to move. A rope of limestone flowed from the cliff face and extended toward the other side. Once it touched, Dante sealed it fast, then drew more from the wall, thickening the bridge from a rope to a trunk. Once it was reasonably thick, he widened it 4 feet across, then stepped back, finished.
Lou blinked.
That doesn't look remotely safe.
Then you'd better cross first, Dante said. That way you'll get it when it's still fresh.
The young monk narrowed his eyes, attempting to read Dante's face, then scowled, moved to the cliff's edge, and explored the bridge with an extended toe. When it failed to pop, groan, or crack, Lou gritted his teeth and edged onto the platform, half-turned so he could leap back to solid ground should it threaten to give out. It held. Lou walked forward, knees bent, hands held out for balance, as if he were walking a tightrope instead of a path as wide as a hallway. As he neared the far side, he picked up his pace, running to the safety of level ground.
"I didn't die!" he hollered.
"Were you joking about him going first?" Ast said.
"Not really," Dante said. "Go ahead, I'll keep an eye on things as you cross."
Ast moved to the bridge, hesitated for a moment, then crossed without so much as a wobble. Dante settled his pack on his shoulders and followed. The bridge was silent and didn't give the slightest bit, but Dante stopped 10 feet across, the chasm yawning below him. He'd never made a crossing of this sort, and had no idea how stable it truly was. He delved into the nether woven into the stone. Looked as strong as when he'd first drawn it across the gap. On its physical surface, however, tiny, pale twigs were mixed into the rock. Dante knelt for a closer look, and nudged a protruding nib with his fingertip. The twig flexed. There were others melded with the rock beside it. He had seen these items before, on dozens if not hundreds of occasions, but given the context, it took him an embarrassingly long time to identify them as fish bones. He glanced up at the others waiting at the end of the bridge. They'd been watching him from his first step. Both had leaned forward when he stopped and knelt to examine the limestone. At this very moment, their expressions were going through a drastic phase transition. Eyes popping, jaws dropping, spines straightening like spears.
"Shit!" Lou screamed.
Assuming the bridge must be collapsing despite all sensory evidence to the contrary, Dante popped to a low crouch, arms held out from his sides. Movement flashed in the corner of his eye. On the side of the ravine he'd just departed, a kappa bounced forward, turf and dust flying from its claws. Dante inhaled so hard he choked. He broke into a dead run across the bridge. Ahead, Ast's sword flashed in the dawn. Dante didn't think about drawing his. If the nether had failed to crack the kappa's hide, there was no hope for steel. The limestone was smooth and slippery. 5 feet from the end, he stumbled, sprawling on palms and knees. The kappa loped onto the bridge, plates clicking. Lou scrambled forward and grabbed Dante, hauling him to his feet. Dante stomped, spiking nether through the platform. A slab of rock sheared off and tumbled away. More followed, tumbling down into the empty space. The remainder of the bridge collapsed beneath the kappa. It honked with ear-punishing fury and leapt from the falling structure. Dante cried out and backed onto solid ground. Ast moved beside him, sword ready. The beast arced toward them through the air, front feet catching the stump of the bridge. The stone shrieked under the kappa's claws. It slid down, scrambling. Then its vast weight pulled it loose. Its call echoed up the ravine. Seconds later, so did the whomp of its impact. Dante edged forward, convinced he would see the kappa up on its feet and already halfway back up the cliff, but all he saw was a squashed black body and a settling bloom of dust. He turned on Ast.
"I thought they only came out at night."
"They do," Ast said. "Did someone forget to tell me today was one of those night days?" "I have never seen nor heard of one hunting during daylight. If they did, we'd never be able to leave the caves." Dante wiped cold sweat from his brow. "Then how do you explain this?" The tall man shook his head. "Maybe we've wandered too close to its home. Or maybe it got the smell of you and wouldn't let go." "Well, we need to get down there for a better look."
"Gross!" Blue said.
"Why?"
"Because that thing battered away the nether like a stray moth. I need to slice it up to learn how it did that. And also for revenge."
Securing the rope to the cliff and then descending took as long as it always did, but the delay gave Dante the chance to ensure the damn thing was well and truly dead. The rock wall was pale limestone, a sharp departure from the black basalt of the foothills. Once Dante stood on the ground, however, he only had eyes for the body, which he approached gingerly, and poked with his sword before coming any closer. It wasn't breathing, and blood pooled beneath it. One of its eyes had been smashed in the fall, the other gazed dully at the cold sky. Lou hung back, nose wrinkled.
Is it...
smashed into monster paste? Dante said. Thoroughly. The fetid odor of viscera